Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities that Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox scholars need for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we get started, please join me in a brief prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen.
Amen.
Today, I have the honor and privilege of speaking with historian Richard Brookhiser, who is a senior editor of National Review and a senior fellow at the National Review Institute. He is a prolific author of many books, mostly on the American founders and their ideas, and many other articles and essays besides. He has specifically written books on Madison, John Marshall, Lincoln, Washington, Hamilton, family of John Adams, and beyond, as well as the criminally neglected Gouverneur Morris. That will be my next Brookhiser book. But the book we're discussing today is Glorious Lessons, or John Trumbull, Painter of the American Revolution, published last year, 2024, by Yale University. This book was specifically one of the finalists for our inaugural Herbert J. Storing Book Prize, which will annually recognize books of exceptional scholarly quality that focused on the ideas of the American founders. Starting here in 2025, and thanks to the generosity of Michael Maybach, a student of the late Herbert Storing, we'll be presenting this award at our annual conference. Nominations for the 2026 prize are now open, so head to the Ciceronian Society website to learn more. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad this book was nominated, and I hope that our listeners what they'll hear today will encourage them to pick up a copy, because it's a great read on an unjustly neglected figure in American history. Also, it may help our listeners to click the link in the show notes and view some of Trumbull's online paintings online for reference. So, all right, enough of my cold, infected voice here. Briefly tell us, as we get started, who John Trumbull was, and help us understand his particular relationship to the Revolution and the founding in a general sense.
Sure. Very few of us know his name or who he was, but most of us have seen his work. He lived from 1756 to 1843, a long life, long career as an artist. He started when he was a little boy in his family's house in Lebanon, Connecticut. He would copy the paintings of his two sisters, which were hung in the parlor over the mantel. He'd copy them on the floor, as he remembered, the nicely sanded floors, probably not so nicely sanded after he got through with his pencil there. But so he always wanted to draw, to paint since his youth. And that did become his career, with a number of twists and turns. And he painted many, many different kinds of things in the course of it, mostly portraits and historical paintings. But his great subject was the American Revolution, which he lived through and also served in. His father was Jonathan Trumbull Sr., who was the last colonial and the first revolutionary governor of Connecticut. So this was a young man who was very politically connected. His father knew everybody who counted. Connecticut was the supplier of the American Revolution. Not many battles fought in Connecticut, only a few towards the end of the war, but it was the arsenal of the Revolution. When the Americans were trying to stop the British advance through upstate New York, they contacted Governor Trumbull. They said, "We need axes. We have to fell trees to block paths that the British hope to take." So he sent them 4,000 axes. And that was the kind of thing that he could do and regularly did. But so his son painted paintings of the American Revolution. His masterpiece was a series of eight of them, which we'll talk about in detail. But You have seen these paintings. You've certainly seen two of them. One of them is on the $2 bill. Not that that's so common, but a larger version of it, a life-size version of it, is in the rotunda of the Capitol. There are four Trumbulls in the rotunda, eight paintings altogether. Half of them are by Trumbull. And the most famous one is the Declaration of Independence. And you've also, I'm sure you've seen that in textbooks, history books. It gets reproduced all the time. It's a great image of a great moment. The committee that was charged with producing the Declaration is handing a copy of it to John Hancock, and all the other members of the Continental Congress are arrayed on either side of them. The other painting from this series that he did that you've almost certainly seen is the very first one in order. That's the death of General Warren at the Battle of Bunker's Hill. And that's probably certainly one of the best battle paintings of the last 250 years. It shows the moment of the third British charge up Bunker Hill, June 17th, 1775. The first two charges were disastrous for the British because they had no artillery cover. Their artillery was on their ships in Boston Harbor, but the cannon could not be elevated enough to cover the troops going up a hill. So they were charging uphill against Americans dug in without artillery cover. The first two charges were just slaughtered. But the third time, the Americans had run out of ammunition. And so this shows the moment when the British are finally going to give it back to these rebels who've been slaying them earlier in the afternoon. The image of it, it's irresistible force versus movable object. The British are surging up the hill, their red uniforms, their flags. The Americans still occupy the top, but they're buckling. One of their great figures is lying dead in the foreground. That's Joseph Warren, patriot orator in Boston. And he's just been shot in the head, killed instantly. The movable object is us. So it's interesting that Trumbull begins this series with an image of defeat. And I think, well, the personal reason for this is that Trumbull was there, not on Bunker's Hill. He was in Roxbury on the other side of Boston. That's where his regiment was. He was there as an adjutant in a Connecticut regiment, a position he got by volunteering for it, but also through his father's connections. But he could hear the musket fire, hear the cannon fire, see the smoke over Boston and on the other side of the city to the north. And so he's depicting this moment because he was there and he saw it, but also to show that revolution is not easy. The struggle is hard. You lose as many as you win. And that's where he begins.
And that was is I'm blanking her name, Abigail Adams. She is she the one who encounters it and has there's a quote in the book where she has an emotional reaction to this painting,
Yes,
right?
yes. Emotional, physical almost. She
Yeah.
said, you know, my blood contracted when I was seeing this. This painting was highly praised. Goethe, the great German writer, he saw it when it was in Germany with an engraver who was going to do a print of it. And there's correspondence with him and Schiller, the other great German writer, and Goethe is praising the painting. There's a story when it was almost done. Trumbull was living in London at the time he was doing this. Let me just back up and explain why he would be there. If you were an American artist in the late 18th century, you had to go to Europe. And we, considering that we were a little country on the edge of civilization, we produced a number of fine painters. But there's no place they could learn here. So they had to go to Europe, Italy, France, or England, where there were artists they could learn from, there was art that they could see and learn from it by copying it, by studying it, by being inspired by it. Trumbull went to London. He was a student there of Benjamin West, who was an American born in Pennsylvania, but he emigrated to England years before the Revolution, and he was George III's history painter. He had an annual retainer from His Majesty, and he was considered one of the two best painters in England at the time. The other best one was Sir Joshua Reynolds. And so when Trumbull is working on this Bunker Hill painting, he's almost finished it. West, very generously, he throws a dinner for the art community in London, which is not that big. Everybody knows everybody. And he has an easel strategically placed, and he puts Trumbull's painting on it so they can all see this. Reynolds comes a little bit late. He immediately sees the painting, goes right up to it, and he says, "West, this is better colored than your work usually is." And West said, "Oh, it's not mine. It's by Mr. Trumbull here. Let me introduce you." So that's another example of people praising this painting. And do go online if you're listening and Google John Trumbull plus Yale University plus Bunker Hill. This painting will come up, and you'll see a good image of it. And the other paintings in the series are also there.
Yeah, and I was surprised by how much time he had spent in England. But you've explained how that's so, especially at that time in history. If you're an artist, you want to do something, you have to make it. And he had some interesting follies there as well. The one where he and the other gentleman had bought a bunch of art they were going to resell, and it gets flooded in a boat. I can't remember where that was.
Yes, well, in the Thames, they'd bought it all in Paris, and the idea was to resell it in London. They were getting it cheap in Paris because of the French Revolution.
So right, right.
The aristocrats had either fled or died, and their art was being unloaded at cheap prices. But when the ship arrived, it was a holiday birthday in the royal family. So the barge, ship to shore barge, was just tied up on the quay, but the leader was not long enough to let it rise with the tide. So when the tide came in, the barge swamped and all the paintings were floating away. They were retrieved, but they required a lot of restoration.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that happened to him in England was he was arrested as a spy.
That's right, yeah.
Now, this happened during the war. So what was an American patriotic painter who was the son of the rebel governor of Connecticut doing in England during the Revolutionary War? Well, it's one of those odd things that distinguishes that era from this. Trumbull was in the Continental Army. He became a colonel. He was briefly on the staff of George Washington, a little longer on the staff of Horatio Gates. And then he resigned because of a quarrel over promotion. He felt his promotion had not been dated early enough so that he lost seniority thereby. And so he quit in a huff. And then he decided, well, let me pursue my art. This is what I've always wanted to do. And he was told, he was assured by a sort of an Anglo-American, a guy who was trying to bring the two sides back together even after the war began. He was assured by this man, look, if you go to London just to study your art, you'll be all right. I have official assurances. So off Trumbull went, and for the longest time, this was true. He went to Benjamin West's studio. He enrolled as a student. And then one night there's a knock on the door and he's arrested. He's taken to a jail, and then he's moved to a prison. And he's there for treason. Benjamin West goes to the king. You know, he's worried about this. And George III says, look, I can't interfere with the prosecution, but I'll promise you that if he's sentenced to death, I will spare his life. I'll give him a pardon. But, you know, that's nice, but you want to get out of jail. And Trumbull is visited by Edmund Burke. He's visited by Charles Fox. These are pro-American members of Parliament. He has to decide, do I want to try and pursue this in court, or should I use political influence? And then finally, somehow the wheels turn, and he's told, okay, you can leave, but you've got to post a bond, and you've got to get out in 30 days. So that's his adventure in prison. And I tried to find out, was he actually spying? I don't think so. They found a letter in his possession, a kind of a suspicious letter from a man with a very bland name, which suggests an alias. And it seemed to me that this was a commercial letter about a money-making ship that could make troublesome money, but it's kind of wordy, which could suggest a code, the presence of a code. But I couldn't see what it was that Trumbull would have been doing over there. So I'm kind of skeptical that he was actually involved in anything secret. Although that'd be a nice TV show. You get an episode of The Turn. But yeah, so Trumbull, he goes to England to learn to become a better artist, and then he goes to France. He meets the American minister to France, who's visited London just on a side trip, who tells him, look, come to France. You can stay with me. You won't have any expenses, and you can meet the Paris art world. And this diplomat is Thomas Jefferson. So Trumbull goes to Paris, lives with Jefferson, does meet the Paris art world, lots of important people. He sees wonderful collections. He's just stunned by the riches that he encounters. He also introduces Jefferson to Richard and Maria Cosway. Richard Cosway is an English miniature painter. Maria, his wife, is also a painter. She's a musician. She's 26 years old, blonde, beautiful. Her husband is 19 years older, and everyone says he looks like a monkey. Jefferson is a widow, grieving, excuse me, widower, grieving widower. He falls hard for Maria, and they have this. Did they have an affair? They certainly had an affair of the heart, letters and correspondence, and they would see each other, and then when the Cosways go back to England, they write, and it's pretty intense for a number of years. And Trumbull, we would say now, is Jefferson's wingman. He's conveying their letters back and forth from France to England, because as Jefferson says, I'm a diplomat. All my letters are open in the post office, both in Paris and in London. So he needs to send them by a private person. So that's an interesting little bit of biographical detail. But for Trumbull's artistic purposes, he's looking at paintings. He's learning lessons in how to paint, and these will stick with him for the rest of his life. The connection with Jefferson is also important because it's Jefferson who suggests that he do a scene of the Declaration of Independence. Now, obviously, Jefferson's motives are, I'll be the star of this painting. And, he is, when you look at it, he's the tallest person in the room. He's the brightest because he's wearing a red waistcoat and he's got reddish hair, so he really pops out. But it's also to make a point to show that this revolution is more than battles. Of course, the battles are vital, they're necessary, and they're crucial. But this painting will show what the revolution is for. And as you look at the painting, if you can go online and see it, or if you can recall it, because I'm sure you've all seen this painting, the committee that was charged with producing this document is standing in front of the table of the President of Congress, five of them. There's John Adams, there's Roger Sherman, Robert Livingston, then there's Jefferson in his red waistcoat handing a piece of paper to John Hancock, and then on Jefferson's right, to the right of him, is Benjamin Franklin. And then the other delegates are off to either side. And of course, we can't read the words on this piece of paper. It's, far too small. But the painting shows us what kind of a country these men were hoping to create. One sign of that is that they're all in civilian clothes. No one here is in uniform. Now, George Washington had come to the Second Continental Congress wearing his old uniform from the French and Indian War. And he was making a statement. He was saying, it's going to come to fighting, and I'm ready, but we should all be ready. But he's already been sent to command the army that's besieging Boston. So everyone left, everyone here, they're civilians, even if they served, in earlier British Imperial Wars. They're all civilians. So this is not a military revolution. It's not a putsch. It's not a coup. These are elected representatives. The other thing we can see is that they're all peers. They're all dressed approximately the same way. This is the clothing of prosperous or wealthy gentlemen. There are a couple of very rich men in this group. Robert Morris is there. He's the merchant prince from Philadelphia. Right behind him is Charles Carroll of Carrollton from Maryland. Someone said when he signed the declaration, somebody said, "There go a few millions." What they're wearing is the same kind of thing as Josiah Bartlett, who's a doctor and a farmer from New Hampshire. So this is all middle class and above. No one is wearing a coronet. No one is wearing an ermine or a fur. No one is wearing a golden chain of rank. There are no ranks. There are no orders of nobility. That's the kind of country they hope to set up. And the other thing, the third thing, is that these men have deliberated. They're sitting there, they've made the decision, they've come to the decision, and now they're paying attention to the act of the product of their discussion being formally presented. And the contrast here is with a sketch by one of Trumbull's friends, one of his friends from the Paris art world, Jacques-Louis David, who did the Oath of the Tennis Court, which is when the Third Estate, which had been summoned by Louis XVI, goes off by itself and declares itself to be a national assembly. We don't just represent the common people of France, we represent all the people of France, and this is the beginning of the French Revolution. And David's picture shows these delegates swearing their oath very dramatically, Roman salutes, arms in the air. It's like the gestures of David's painting, The Oath of the Horatii, which was a classical Roman scene of three brothers swearing to defend the Republic against its enemies, and their arms are jutting upwards. But that's not this. This is not a moment of passion. This is a moment of decision, and then the business of governing and acting will continue. So those are important points about this new country, and Trumbull conveys them visually. We think of history as words. And I certainly have that bias. I'm a writer, been a writer all my life. And when we think of history, Herodotus is the father of history. He's called the father of history. A writer, great writer. Thucydides, another Greek, Tacitus, lots of great Roman historians, and on up to the present day. But history can also be conveyed and explained visually. And that's what Trumbull does. He tells Jefferson, he writes a letter to Jefferson. This is after 3 years of living with him or corresponding with him in Paris, because Trumbull does go back to London. He goes back and forth. And then Jefferson makes an offer, look, why don't you spend more time here? I have to go back to the United States for a while, but I'm going to come back. I'm going to lose my assistant. I'm going to lose my secretary. He's going to go back and stay. So why don't you come to Paris and not just be my guest, but be my secretary. And then Trumbull writes him a letter and says, you know, thank you for the offer, but no, I want to pursue my art. And my purpose in doing this is to give present and future sons of misfortune glorious lessons of their rights and how they should maintain and uphold them. And that's really the credo for the rest of Trumbull's life. I want to give glorious lessons to present and future sons of misfortune of their rights. And this becomes the series of paintings which he finally completes. It takes him 45 years. Lots of distractions, lots of time spent doing other things, often doing nothing. But he will finish it when he's an old man. And the start, the inspiration is these years in London and Paris in the mid to late 1780s.
Yeah, and it brings a key insight you have toward the end of the book is this theme. You've elaborated on it a little bit. If you want to elaborate on it more, is that this one of the lessons, one of the glorious lessons, is the lesson of self-rule, what it takes, what it looks like, why we should pursue it. And I think that's really interesting because it's not just in the paintings you mentioned, it's in the other ones as well. I'm certainly a fan of Bunker's Hill and Declaration of Independence. I also was very struck by his painting of Washington returning his commission in Annapolis.
The Resignation.
Yeah.
Yes, let's talk about that one. That's one of the ones that's in the rotunda of the Capitol.
Yeah.
Let me briefly explain. The British burned everything in the War of 1812.
Right.
Or all the public buildings in Washington. They didn't harm private property, but they gutted the White House. They gutted the Capitol. So it had to be rebuilt. And Trumbull, he's getting on in years, but he sees now this is my opportunity because they've got to rebuild the Capitol, but it also needs decoration. So let me lobby to do paintings to decorate this renewed building. And he's well connected enough that he makes it happen. He gets a commission from Congress to do four paintings for the Rotunda. And he discusses with President Madison what the subject should be. And Madison actually suggests Bunker Hill. And Trumbull says, no, I want to do surrenders. You know, American receiving the surrenders of British armies. So I want to do my painting of Saratoga, and I want to do Yorktown. And okay, so Madison accepts that, and I want to do the Declaration. And then Madison said, "What's the fourth? What should the fourth be?" And Trumbull says, "Washington resigning his commission at the end of the war." And Madison said, "That was a very noble action." So this was a painting that Trumbull does very late in the whole series. It's the last one chronologically of the subjects, and it's the very last one that he actually paints. And this moment, it's December of 1783. The Yorktown is October 1781, but the diplomats take a long time to settle the shape of this newly independent country. The Treaty of Paris is finally inked in the summer of 1783. And so then the British have to evacuate the places in the United States that they still occupy. That's Charleston and New York City. The British leave New York City in November. Washington's army comes south through Manhattan as the British are departing from the battery at the southern tip of it. Washington bids farewell to his officers at Francis Tavern. That's a very emotional moment. But then he writes to Congress and he says, "All right, what do you want me to do now? How shall I surrender to you my commission as commander in chief?" And Congress says, "Well, you come to us." They are sitting in Annapolis. They'd been in Philadelphia, but they'd had to leave Philadelphia because there'd been a demonstration, almost a riot, by unpaid junior officers. And so Congress decamped first to Princeton, and then they went to Annapolis, Maryland, in the State House, which is still the Maryland State House. And they said to Washington, you come to us and you return your commission to us here. And this happens at the end of December 1783. And Trumbull depicts the scene. So of the eight paintings that he does, four are battles, two American defeats, two American victories, two are surrenders, Saratoga and Yorktown, and two are political. Two occur in Congress, the first being the Declaration. That's in Congress in 1776. And now we're going to get Washington's resignation, 1783. So these are the two political scenes in this drama of eight paintings. And they form a parenthesis. They talk to each other across the years. In the Declaration, Jefferson is handing his piece of paper to our right, handing it to John Hancock. In the resignation, Washington is in the center of the painting, and he's handing his piece of paper, which is his commission, to our left. He's handing it to the president of Congress and the other congressmen who are seated in front of him, that is to our left in the State House in Annapolis. Now, the two things about this painting, the resignation painting, that are new in the series, one is the presence of women. We have women in the visitor's gallery, which is in the upper right-hand corner of the painting. And there are also two girls on the floor of Congress. They're with their father, who's Charles Carroll, once again, the wealthy delegate from Maryland. And he's got a protective arm over the shoulders of one of them. These are his daughters, Mary and Patsy. They were 5 and 13 at the time. They were actually there. Up in the visitor's gallery, Trumbull puts Martha Washington, who wasn't actually there. She was at Mount Vernon waiting for her husband to come. He also puts her granddaughter, Nellie Custis. And then he puts Harriet Wadsworth, who was a woman he hoped to marry, but who died of tuberculosis. So he remembers her by putting her there. And this is to show what revolution should be for. Now, this is normal life. If revolutions don't end with this, with the ability to go home and to have a home, then they're just bloodshed. You know, they're just a sick man turning over in bed. Yeah. What have you accomplished? But this is the goal. This represents the goal. The other thing about this painting, which makes it different from the Declaration painting, this is Congress. They're both scenes in Congress. But now this time there are a lot of uniforms. You know, Washington is in uniform. There are other officers behind him, you know, facing in the same direction towards the congressmen who are all on the left. And with just a little tweaking, historically and visually, this could be Cromwell dismissing Parliament. This could be Napoleon and his brother dismissing the Directory. Now, this is a common scene in revolutions. The fighters say, we've been bleeding, we've been dying, you've been talking. All right, now we're going to run things. You're going to leave. We've been doing the real work. Now we're going to have the real power. But that's not what these officers are doing. That's not what this general is doing. Washington is never going to do that. And behind him in the painting, there's a chair. Chairs can be thrones. You know, it's a visual symbol. It can be a throne. But Washington is not sitting in this chair. He will never sit in that throne chair. There's also a cloak on the chair, a reddish-purple cloak. And cloaks, and especially of those colors, indicate royalty or imperial power. When David paints Napoleon crossing the Alps, sure you've all seen the painting. He's on this rearing horse and he's gesturing. He's got a great big dark red cloak billowing behind him. Washington's not wearing such a cloak. So this is a sign that he is not going to take that role. He's not going to usurp the power and become a king himself. And no one will. So those are the visual messages that this painting conveys, and this is the end of Trumbull's revolutionary series.
It also seems to be, especially toward the end of his life, this style of historical painting is going out of style, right? It's giving way to photography eventually, right? And we still have historical painting, but he's part of that last kind of generation of like West, Peale, Copley, Stewart, those folks he also crosses paths with. I maybe situate him in that moment of where historical painting has been and is going at his by the end of his life.
You mentioned these Anglo-American painters, and we had quite a number of good ones. West, of course, moved to England, became George III's painter. Copley was a loyalist and moved to England at the very beginning of the Revolution. He left some wonderful portraits of Americans before he went. He did a great Sam Adams. It's just a terrific painting. Adams seems almost to burst out of the canvas. He's confronting the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Province, but he's really like confronting us, the viewers. Gilbert Stuart, great portraitist. Trumbull admired his portrait work highly. Stuart did the George Washington that's on the dollar bill. And he never finished the painting. He deliberately never finished the painting because he wanted to keep doing copies of it. That's how he made money. He would churn out copies of this portrait, and George Washington would write him now and again, how's the portrait going? And he never finally gets it. And Peale, Charles Wilson Peale, and his children. Peale had a big family. Name them all for painters. There was a Titian Peale and a Raphael Peale, and it was he had quite a number of them, and they all followed their father as painters. So historical painting, it does go on, but the first big change is nature painting, and Trumbull sees that. He sees in a shop window in New York City when he's an older man, he sees a painting by Thomas Cowles. And it's a nature scene. And he thinks, this is terrific stuff. And he tells two artist friends of his, come look at this. And Cowles actually has three paintings in the shop, and they buy them all. Each one buys one of these paintings. And Trumbull very generously pushes him. But this is the next wave that's going to, engage artists and engage viewers. People want to see the glories of America, of this continent, of this wilderness, or wilderness being conquered, about to be conquered. So there's that, and then photography begins to be developed. It takes a while for it to be able to do more than portraits or very static landscape scenes, although we do get photographers of the Crimean War and of the Civil War. But of course they can't do action shots. They can do after battle shots. They can show you here's where the fighting was. Sometimes here are the dead afterwards. And when we look at historical paintings of the kind that Trumbull does, we have to remember that he's not trying, when he does a scene, he's not trying to do a photograph of the scene. I mean, obviously not, because he's never seen a photograph. But the point is not to get an instantaneous image of something. He wants to show an episode, but he also wants to explain it. He wants to give you context of it. He would never say, well, this is an exact moment in the Continental Congress when the Declaration is done. In fact, he says in his like program notes that he eventually wrote for this series of paintings, he says, look, I know that when a committee presents its work to a larger body, what usually happens is they sit in their chairs and the chairman of the committee rises from his chair with their report or whatever it is they're presenting. But instead, he brings the entire committee forward to give it to the president of Congress. Well, he's doing that just to show you who these men were. Okay, here are the men on the committee. He's also put men in the room who weren't all there at any one moment. You know, because the signing happened over a number of days. People came later who hadn't actually been there when the vote was taken to approve independence. So it's not a moment in time, it's an episode that he's trying to give us. Similarly with Washington's resignation, one of the congressmen he shows there is James Madison. Well, James Madison was not in Annapolis when Washington presented his resignation. He was a member of Congress, but he was home at Montpelier because his father was ill. He was taking care of his father. But Trumbull put him there because, as he said, I want all the Virginia presidents in my series of paintings. And this is my chance to get Madison in there. So there he is. And so that's how our viewing of history has changed over time because of technological developments.
Yeah. And I can't remember who the quote was from, but there's somebody who comes to America or somebody in England and they see a Trumbull painting and this gentleman says, that's America's painter. And then you come back in the book and say, no one would say that today, right? It would right. More likely be Thomas Cole. And I'm a fan of Thomas Cole. My wife and I also like to buy paintings of Albert Bierstadt. That's who I think of in that nature painting. But I'm wondering, because I think you're right. I think he was displaced in many ways by these nature painters. What do you think we've lost in that displacement, if anything? Maybe that's the wrong question, but I was that was a moment where I was reading the book and I put it down and I said, oh, never thought of that. That transition from the historical to the nature focus.
Well, you know, then to nature, and then we've had other focuses. I mean, we've had like slice of life focuses.
Right.
You know, you've all seen a million times that powerful painting, Nighthawks, of, you know, the lonely people in the all-night diner.
Oh, yeah.
And then there are all the joke versions of it where they stick Elvis Presley in there, or an alien, or Marilyn Monroe, or who knows what. But, so you know, art has diversified, and we have all kinds of different subjects. The man who said this is America's painter was Thackeray, and he was being given a tour of the Capitol by Senator Sumner. And, you know, Thackeray was an artist himself, so it wasn't, you know, it was an informed opinion when he said it. I said in the book, well, no one would say that now. And I don't think art critics would say that now. They wouldn't say that now. The art world now wouldn't say that now. But on the other hand, these images do march on. You know, they do march on. How many people go through the rotunda every day, every year? I mean, lots of people, not just the people who work there, but tourists. You know, they want to see the Capitol. They come, they bring their families, they look around, they see these paintings. And they've probably seen, they may have seen the Declaration when they were in school. You know, it was in some textbook or some lesson plan that they had. So they say, oh yeah, there it is. And so these images do persist. You know, Washington crossing the Delaware, which is a later 1850s by a German artist, Emanuel Leutze. We've all seen that. So some of these paintings have survived, have registered. I think it's interesting that we don't have similar paintings of the Civil War or later wars. Mm-hmm. We do have the Iwo Jima statue. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is iconic. I think everyone recognizes that. If they see a picture of it, oh, yes, I've seen that. So there are some visual images that do survive, and even some photographs. I mean, there was that terrible photograph from the Vietnam War of the young a girl who was fleeing from a napalm attack. You know, she's like naked, her clothes have been burned off, and that was on the cover of Newsweek, I think, or Time. So that's in our minds. And stills from the Zapruder film, you know, of JFK's assassination. There are images that we retain, but painting hasn't seemed to supply them.
Yeah, and I want to conclude and give you one last word here. Is one of the things I'd like that I think this book could inspire other scholars who come through our conferences and our journal and others to look into these other sources of American history and American political thought, American political development, because this seems a little different than some of the other things you've written. You've written on the American founding and other founders. But this, you know, turning to a painter, I thought was really a really interesting turn. And I wonder if there's other opportunities for younger historians and younger scholars who are looking for these other entrances into the discussion about the American tradition, like a Trumbull. You know, where are some opportunities there that you think may have been overlooked that might be worth pursuing?
Music.
Hmm.
I was just at a Lincoln Day celebration and it concluded with the Battle Hymn of the Republic. You know, a very moving poem of a certain, you know, public and also religious. I mean, it's really a hymn. It's a hymn. And the music is stirring. And that's far from the only interesting piece of historical music. You can look at literature. Rip Van Winkle is one of the best expressions of the loyalist view of the revolution. You know, Rip sleeps through the revolution. Remember when he wakes up and he finally goes back to his village and everything is different? Well, an election is going on. And he's like, what? He doesn't understand. What is this? Some guy's giving an election speech. And he's got his gun, which is rusted out over the 20 years he's been asleep. And someone said, hey, well, what are you bringing a gun to a political rally for? And he says, I'm not trying to make trouble. I'm just a loyal subject of His Majesty. And they say, what? You're a Tory? You know, and it's funny. And then he says who he is, and they figure it out, and it's a comic moment. But it's also a moment about this big change that's happened in American life. And Washington Irving, who was certainly an American patriot, I mean, he's named after George Washington, and the last book he writes is a biography of George Washington. But he's a man of sympathies, and so he can see, well, this could be a big jolt for a lot of people. You know, and he made this comic character, Rip Van Winkle, to express that. James Fenimore Cooper, writing about the French and Indian War, about the colonial period. And he's really, you know, it's an adventure story. You know, it's the first Western, even though it's in upstate New York. But he's also giving you history. He's showing you what's happening on this frontier. What are the forces at play? What are the races at play? He's got white people, he's got Indians, he also has black people in the series of novels that he wrote. And you can go on and on and look at, you know, great works of literature, maybe second-rank works of literature, but see what their political, you know, what the political meanings are. And not even like polemical pieces or propaganda pieces, but you know, literary works depicting people's lives, but that also show where they are and what they're involved in. And let me just say, you mentioned that this was an unusual book for me because it's about a, you know, it's not about a leader, it's about a painter, but it was really an autobiography. because Trumbull did, I mean, much, better and with more first-hand view, obviously, what I've tried to do. And he, he's not Washington. I'm not Washington. But we can point to Washington. We know that this is something special, that something important happened here, something glorious, potentially glorious, actually glorious. And we can point to it and we could say, look, understand this. This is important. This affects us now. This was meant to affect us now. So take a good look at it.
Well, that is a great note to end on. Richard, I cannot thank you enough for doing this. We're grateful to have you. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, you've been listening to the Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. And if you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. At the time of this recording, our 2025 conference is sold out, but we're working on confirming a date and location for our 2026 conference soon, which, by the way, will focus significantly on the American founding, given the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence next year. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.